PioneerFunds.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. We had an election this week, which means the people have spoken. But what exactly did they say? We probably won't know for a while. Official results of the recount in Florida won't be available until next week. And now there are rumblings about recounts in Iowa, Wisconsin, New Mexico, and Oregon. It's clear that the people protesting in Florida have something to say, both in Palm Beach and at the State House in Tallahassee. Angry voters are demanding a revote because of some 19,000 disqualified ballots. Weren't we just talking last week about the disengaged electorate? Everyone, it seems, has an opinion on how this election should end. We'd like to know what you think. Does this qualify as a crisis? Does the contest over this tight race banish or heighten cynicism about the process? We'll continue our conversation this morning about this week's historic election with Darrell West. He's a professor of political science at Brown University in Rhode Island. He joins us by phone. Professor West, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Okay. Now, we might not know anything at the earliest until November 17th next week, perhaps even longer if we have recounts. What impact does this delay have?
I think it's going to prove problematic from a public opinion standpoint because Americans are used to knowing their president basically by 9 or 10 o'clock on election night. We are all in uncharted territory here, and I think eventually people will grow impatient with legal wrangling and kind of a partisan squabbling over does this ballot count or does that ballot count. And I think after the overseas ballots come in next Friday, a week from today, there's going to be increased pressure to basically move ahead.
How do you think this situation, for lack of a better word, is affecting the country?
I would not characterize this as a crisis yet, but it certainly has the potential to move to that stage. I mean, right now we're basically at the stage where we're checking the machine tallies and perhaps doing a manual recount of some individual ballots. And as long as it stays at that level, I would not put this in the category of a crisis. However, if we end up in a situation where you essentially end up with contested races in several different states, Iowa, Wisconsin, and New Mexico. Also, those margins were decided by a few thousand votes. You could easily see this whole thing unraveling to the point of just partisan sniping, lawyers jumping in, and reaching a point where it makes it very difficult for us to resolve the issue and for whoever emerges as the new president to have any type of public legitimacy.
All right. If you had done a disengagement barometer or a cynicism barometer last week, how different would it read this week?
It would read pretty different. In the last week of the campaign, there were a lot of people, in fact, more than experts anticipated, actually getting engaged in the campaign, turning out to vote, being interested in the result. And, of course, now there is an incredible level of interest and probably not that much cynicism yet, but that's the part that could change depending on how this plays out. And I think as a country, we have to be very careful to respect the Constitution, understand the legal processes, and abide by them and make sure that, you know, this doesn't turn out to be a case of a sore loser contesting it, you know, whether the loser turns out to be Bush or Gore.
That's interesting you said that. Stephen Carter from the Yale School of Law, the author of Civility and Integrity, was on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour last night, and he said there are things more important in democracy than winning or pursuing individual rights, that there are also such things as leadership and grace. I'd like to hear your response to that.
Oh, I agree 100% with that. I mean, my greatest fear out of all this is that we will have two individuals who are so interested in their own election prospects that they end up undertaking actions that damage the political system as a whole. Because in a democracy, the glue that really holds all of us together is trust, faith in the process, respect for the outcome. And if we end up in a situation where you have charges and countercharges, fraud, corruption, you know, is the process really secure? You know, were people's basic rights respected? That's really not good from the standpoint of the overall political system. And at some point, we are going to have to move ahead. There will be a president that comes out of that. But we need somebody who is strong enough to actually lead. I mean, the United States is still the most powerful country in the world, and we need strong leadership.
Yeah, but there are also those who would argue that the focus shouldn't be on Bush or Gore pursuing their individual rights, but the focus should be on voters who feel they were disenfranchised in this process.
I know there are some voters who feel that way, but there really are two types of things we need to distinguish. One is if there was evidence of outright fraud or manipulation of the process, I mean, that is clearly illegal. That clearly would be grounds for instituting a very serious remedy. But the other part of it is if it's merely poor ballot design, if there was ineptitude on the part of some election officials, if there was ineptitude on the part of the two candidate organizations in not contesting a ballot structure that was publicized well before this election, that's not fraud. There is a distinction between ineptitude and fraud. We have ineptitude in every American election. You know, polling places open late, they close early, machines break down. You know, people get inconvenienced and sometimes even lose the right to express their preference. Courts typically have not ruled those types of things as invalidating an entire election. And my sense is that most judges are going to be reluctant to intervene in the process unless there's pretty clear overriding evidence of fraud.
We're going to go to Jim. He's calling us from Eagan. Jim, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thanks. I've just got a couple comments. I hope that what comes out of this is the people will see a need to pass an amendment to abolish the Electoral College, and while they're at it, they could pass an amendment to have a runoff election if no one candidate has the majority vote.
Has a clear majority passed a certain percentage.
You know, as an example right here in Minnesota, where Jesse Ventura was elected governor, and yet over half of the people didn't vote for him.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Well, we are certainly going to have a national debate on the Electoral College versus direct popular voting that comes out of this. But people should actually step back from this individual case before they jump to a conclusion that the Electoral College is the major flaw here, because the Electoral College really was set up to balance the rights of small, medium, and large states. If you have direct popular voting, the large states will emerge in a much stronger position than they are now, and small and medium-sized states will lose a lot of power. I mean, this was an election year where small and medium-sized states actually were quite important. In New England, New Hampshire was very much in contention. Bush ultimately took it. There were lots of ads that were being run there. Arkansas, Tennessee, Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, you know, places that aren't that big, but because of the Electoral College, candidates had to take them seriously. If the thing that people really worried about with the Electoral College is the split outcome, there is an easy remedy for that. It's called a bonus plan, in which we would simply make an amendment in which we'd keep the Electoral College but give whoever wins the popular vote a bonus of 20 Electoral College votes. That would virtually guarantee that there would never again be a split between the popular vote and the Electoral College. So my personal sense is the Electoral College actually serves us pretty well in balancing a number of different objectives. Moving to direct popular election of the president would fundamentally change the nature of our presidential system in ways that a lot of people probably would not like.
We are talking to Darrell West. He's a professor of political science at Brown University in Rhode Island. We're continuing this morning's conversation on this week's historic presidential election. We'd like to have you join this conversation with your questions and your observations. 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities. It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Kathy in Rochester. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question. The first is that I voted on a butterfly ballot in Illinois for 8 years that was very similar to the one that was used in Palm Springs, Florida. I saw it in the newspaper yesterday. And we used it in Illinois without a problem. I mean, I just saw nothing confusing about it. So that's my comment. And my question is, if Palm Springs, Florida, had almost 15,000 ballots thrown out.
Palm Beach. Palm Beach, I believe.
Palm Beach, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're right. Palm Beach had almost 15,000 ballots thrown out in 1996 when voter turnout was lower than this year. Why didn't they fix the problem? I mean, it's not like they didn't have 4 years to work on it. They had 15,000 thrown out in 96 and 19,000 thrown out this year when the voter turnout was much higher.
Kathy, I thank you for that comment and question. Daryl West?
It's an excellent question. I do not have the answer to that. Certainly, this problem is not unique to this particular year, as your caller pointed out. In 1996, we had almost as many ballots who were or that were disqualified due to exactly the same type of problem. You would have thought they would have addressed the issue then. I mean, my sense is that even though there clearly was a problem for some people there, the ballot was circulated in advance. The parties and the candidates had a chance to object to it. No one objected. And that's the type of situation that a judge is going to have to consider, whether the problems were fundamental enough, given the fact that there was previous disclosure and previous problems here to invalidate the election in that county. In fact, the ultimate outcome of this presidential election may come down to this key legal issue.
And that key legal issue, again, is?
The ballot in Palm Beach County.
And I have just seen, I believe it was in the New York Times, they did a story that said that, if nothing else, this imbroglio is going to highlight how we really don't have a voting system. We call it a voting system, but there's no system there. Every county does it the way it wants to in all sorts of different versions, depending on how much money they have and how important they think it is. We have computer voting. We have tab voting. You know, we pull the lever. We have punch card voting. What do you think is going to change?
You're exactly right. You know, when you look at American elections, our procedures are actually surprisingly weak. You know, it's ironic that the United States often sends election observers and election experts to other countries to oversee their elections, you know, to safeguard the security. Our process actually has a lot of problems. Now, in the past, we've never worried a whole lot about it because, you know, people have often thought that, you know, whatever errors took place were idiosyncratic. They were randomly distributed, so there wasn't a systematic disadvantage for either Republicans or Democrats. What happened this time is, you know, through a confluence of just weird circumstances in a very close election, all this stuff suddenly matters in a way that it never has before. So my hope is that we will have a national discussion on cleaning up our process such that we never have this type of problem again.
So, in a sense, is this situation good for the country?
It could be good if we address the fundamental problems and not get sidetracked into, you know, either Democrats complaining about a Republican who wins or a Republican complaining about a Democrat who wins. I mean, my fear is that is going to emerge as the central issue, which in my view is not the central issue. It's really the integrity of the election process and, you know, having a fair election. So I hope we can address whatever the procedural issues are that created this this crisis.
Now, you, I know both sides have accused the other of politicizing this situation. How would you grade them?
Well, I mean, clearly it's the person who's behind who has to lob the first grenade. And, you know, Gore was in that position, so he was the one who raised the a possibility of a legal challenge. And then, of course, what happens after he raises, you know, problems in Florida is then Republicans start looking at other states. You know, there have been allegations of voting problems in New Mexico, and Iowa and Wisconsin are very close. And that's what I fear, that essentially the whole thing unravels, and essentially we start contesting everything that took place. And, you know, when you have a national election with over 100 million people having voted, you know, we can't do another election. We can't recount the entire country without kind of paralyzing our system for several months. You know, at some point we have to recognize that even with problems in our system, you know, we are going to have to come to a resolution.
Let's go to Bob in Winona. Bob, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
There are an estimated 3,000 absentee ballots still to be counted and received in Florida, which obviously has a significant impact on the margin of only 327. It just seems incredibly premature and very undemocratic to assume the outcome of those results. It's like assuming Minnesota usually votes Democrat and saying, well, we know you haven't voted yet, but we'll just assume you're Democrat.
But, Bob, that's why people are waiting. They have through November 17th.
Bush has already assumed that he's the winner and is setting up a team. And for a candidate who campaigned on the promise of restoring honor and dignity to the White House, it seems I see neither honor or dignity in claiming victory this early.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Professor West?
Well, the only thing we have to go on is the past. And in 1996, there were roughly 2,300 such overseas ballots that came in, 54% of which went for the Republican candidate, Bob Dole. His margin among that group was about 10 percentage points higher than it was for the state of Florida as a whole. So that is what has led some observers to think that that is Bush's ace in the hole and where he might do well. But, of course, you know, there are idiosyncratic features of Lieberman being on the ticket, perhaps more than is typical of those overseas ballots are going to come from Israel and may tilt that pool in more of a Democratic direction. Nobody knows, and we'll really have to wait until next Friday to find the answer to that one.
Let's go to John in North St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello. Most of the focus has been on Al Gore. What's he going to do? Why doesn't he concede? But if Bush trusts people and can bring people together like he says, then why doesn't he readily agree to a revote in Palm Beach County? I think he has the perfect chance to prove his own claim.
All right. Thank you, John.
A judge is not going to order a reballoting in Palm Beach County unless there is a very high bar of evidence that is met. Merely having a confusing ballot in and of itself is probably not going to meet that threshold.
Well,
look at other legal cases that have come up, the fact that this kind of ballot has been used elsewhere.
I don't think he was asking about the legal challenge aspect of it. I think what I was hearing him ask is, look, Bush is a great politician. Can he politically simply ask for another vote?
No, I don't think he would, nor would I advise him to in that situation, because that would actually be a very unpleasant precedent to set, because Palm Beach County is not the only place where there have been ballot problems in this election. Obviously, it is the most well-publicized at this point. And if you kind of establish the precedent that if there's a confusing ballot and people are unhappy with the results, then we should just reballot, that would create real problems for American elections at a variety of different levels. And because, you know, that's a problem that has cropped up in a lot of different places. There are places, and this often happens in urban areas, where, you know, the polls are supposed to open at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock. You know, the poll workers don't show up. They open an hour late. You know, that, you know, systematically denies some people the opportunity to vote. And it's not at all clear to me that in any of those types of situations we should automatically assume that reballoting is the fairest outcome.
Now, earlier we were talking, in fact, about cleaning up, you know, perhaps one of the good things about the situation is that we'll clean up our elections system, our elections process. What do you think needs to be cleaned up?
I think there are a lot of aspects. I mean, I would start first with media organizations and exit polls. There were, you know, just tremendous problems this year with the networks jumping the gun, announcing the results before an entire state had closed. The Florida exit poll obviously being inaccurate by 6 or 7 percentage points. So those are all things that I think have to be addressed. There have been proposals to have uniform poll closing times across the country. That would help eliminate this problem of the networks jumping the gun. And we also are going to have to think pretty systematically about having such a decentralized election system, because as it stands now, states basically have the authority to set up their election systems however they want, And in places like Florida, counties have the right to design their ballot however they want. You know, that is what, in part, has aggravated the problem because, you know, people move around. You know, 10% of Americans move in any given year. You know, you may grow used to a certain ballot structure where you live, but then you move to a new place, it's a new ballot structure, and you may personally find that confusing. You know, one result out of all this is we may need to move to more consistent ballot designs just to eliminate that type of confusion on the part of voters.
Let's go to Jody in Grantsburg, Wisconsin. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
I was hoping your guest would further explain why an electoral process system is superior to a popular vote system, because it seems to me that it's only during campaigning that candidates give attention to states, and then they even go to states that have the most electoral votes. And in fact, it seems like the electoral process might actually take away people's power by granting the candidates all the state's electoral votes, when in fact the popular vote might be very close.
That's a very good question, and certainly, you know, that's going to be a big part of the national debate that we have on this. But my sense is the reason why I generally am sympathetic to the Electoral College as opposed to direct popular voting is when you look at other countries that have direct popular voting, France is one example, and there are others as well, typically you have a number of candidates that run. Nobody can ever get 40% on the first ballot, and so typically you need to have a runoff provision if nobody gets 40%, which is the typical threshold. And it would be a revolutionary change in American politics if we move to direct popular election. I mean, some people seem to think that we could just make that change and nothing else would change, and we'd basically end up with the same type of system, only, you know, one based on one person, one vote. And that would not likely be the case. We would basically undermine the two-party system through a direct popular voting process. We would run the risk of having a bunch of parties that would make it difficult for anyone to achieve a majority. There's always the possibility if you have a crowded ballot that an extremist might end up in the runoff, which then distorts the process. So there are all sorts of consequences that I think a lot of people would not like if they realize those were the types of things that would become more possible under such a fundamental change in our political system.
We're talking to Darrell West. He's a professor of political science at Brown University in Rhode Island, talking to him about, of course, this historic and amazing presidential election. We'd like to continue to take your calls, questions, and observations at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Stephen John. He's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine. Cuba is suggesting a new vote should be held to ease the U.S. presidential election turmoil, and it's offering to send observers to ensure fairness. The communist nation blames the uncertainty surrounding the balloting on Castro foes in Florida. Florida's closely watched vote count isn't the only one still in question. Four more states may see their presidential votes end with recounts. In Oregon, a recount may be required by state law if the margin between Bush and Gore were less than 1/5 of 1%, or about 2,800 votes. With about 40,000 more votes to be counted, Gore leads Bush by around 8,400 votes. In Iowa, Republican officials are exploring the possibility of requesting a recount in the state where Bush lost by less than 5,000 votes. In Wisconsin, Bush lost by about 6,000 votes. In New Mexico, the margin of difference between Bush and Gore was slim, and the continuing vote count was being closely monitored. Bridgestone Firestone's massive tire recall is hurting the company's sales. Sales of Firestone replacement tires for cars and light trucks were down 40% in the U.S. over the last 2 months compared to a year ago. The tires are linked to at least 119 highway deaths in America. A decline in smoking means less money for smoking prevention efforts and medical education at the University of Minnesota. As part of the state's 1998 tobacco settlement, a projected $1.3 billion was set aside for endowments, but when tobacco companies shipped less product, their payments to the endowments went down. Minnesota property owners are about to get a peek at next year's tax bill. Counties throughout the state will begin mailing the annual truth in taxation statements today. The notices estimate next year's property tax on individual homes, businesses, and other property. Forecast is for mostly cloudy skies, a chance of light snow or flurries in the north today, highs in the upper 20s to upper 30s. In Bemidji, 28 degrees, Rochester has 28, and in the Twin Cities, it's cloudy and 31. That's news from Minnesota Public Radio.
This week on Dale Connolly Reporting, hopeful job applicants for the new administration.
I have a reference list of former friends who say I am the most judgmental person they've ever met. So, you know, that would make me a pretty good judge.
Dale Connolly Reporting, Friday night at 11 and Saturday afternoon at 2 on Minnesota Public Radio in the Twin Cities, KNOW 91.1 FM.
Programming is supported in part by the members of Minnesota Public Radio's Leadership Circle. For information, call 800-227-2811. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're continuing our conversation with Daryl West. He's a professor of political science at Brown University in Rhode Island. He joins us by phone. You may as well. 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Of course, the lines have been busy all day. If you just want to take the numbers and hope to get in a minute or so, that'll work out. Let's go to Gail in River Falls, Wisconsin. Gail, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. I have more of a political comment than a legal comment, and that is that I would think both candidates would be rushing to concede to the other because whoever gets in is going to have a deadlocked legislature to deal with, and is going to be a lame duck from the word go. I mean, neither one of them will be able to accomplish anything because the whole process of this election has been really decertified in the American public mind rather than legally or whatever. And I would think that that's something they would be looking at, but they don't seem to be.
All right. Thanks, Gail. Professor?
That's actually a very perceptive comment. When you look at American history at the past when we've had contested elections that were very controversial, in every case, whoever won the presidency turned out to be a one-term president, and whoever was in that situation basically couldn't accomplish anything because they kind of start discredited, not having the same degree of public legitimacy. You know, half the people are upset with them before they've done a single thing. And so whoever becomes president here certainly is starting in a weak position. The only thing that alters that is if the president turns out to be Bush, even though Congress is closely divided between Republicans and Democrats, Republicans are going to be in charge. Now, they don't have enough of a margin that they can bring about major policy changes, but they can certainly make appointments and do a lot of the behind-the-scenes things that could make a difference.
I know that in France they have ridiculed this election as something worthy of a banana republic. Cuba just today has offered to send over advisors if there's a new vote. They blame the uncertainty surrounding the balloting on Castro foes in Florida. How are we seen in the world in the wake of this election?
Well, I think those comments say it all. You know, most people outside of America do not understand our version of democracy, even under the best of circumstances. But there certainly is a lot to ridicule now. And that's really the problem that, you know, right now I don't think we have reached the stage of a crisis, but you can see this developing into a situation where we actually do start to look like a banana republic. And, you know, that would just be catastrophic,
not just
in terms of our internal politics, but for how we are seen abroad.
Are we really, however, a subject for ridicule at this point? Could it be that people outside this country don't necessarily understand the process here? I can certainly see someone making the argument that, hey, this is great. This is democracy in action.
I don't think too many people are pleased right now with how this is developing, and certainly in a couple of weeks after we've had, you know, 2 weeks of partisan and legal wrangling, you know, there's going to be even greater discontent and more foreign criticism. You know, all these places that we have criticized in the past for having unfair elections, distorted processes, unclear procedures, you know, I mean, essentially they will take advantage of our circumstance to say, you know, why are you people so moralistic about how great your system is? You know, you are having the very same problems that you've always criticized us for.
We're going to go to Marvin in Hibbing. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello?
Hi, Marvin.
Yes. I don't see why this is getting all this attention simply because it is a national issue and it's so close. But if there's a known problem with the ballot in that county, that people should be able to ask for and get a rerun with the same ballots, knowing what the problem is.
Thanks, Marvin. Professor?
Well, I mean, it's the same issue that came up earlier, that having poor ballot design in and of itself, according to past court rulings, does not necessitate the remedy of having a new election. And again, if you think about the type of precedent that would get established if that was the norm, we would have lots of elections that would have to be rerun in this country, because some of the types of things that have come up in Florida are not unique to Palm Beach County, are not unique to the state of Florida, and are not unique to election 2000. They actually are more prevalent than anybody previously has realized.
Well, what about those who make the point that many of the ballots were disqualified there because people had voted twice with them? Now, isn't it pretty clear in this country that in terms of individual responsibility, most of us know you shouldn't vote twice on a ballot?
That's my sense, and that has been the way judges have ruled in the past. I mean, voters do have some responsibility to be able to figure things out. If they approach a ballot and it's confusing, they can go seek help. Under Florida law, if you are confused, you end up voting for two different candidates and realize you made a mistake, you can immediately go to the people at your polling place and say, look, I'm sorry I made a mistake. They will give you a new ballot. You can correct it on the spot. Those people did not do that. And so the question is really, you know, what at some level voters do have to take responsibility for making mistakes.
Let's go to Dean in Golden Valley. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a comment regarding what I think is the eventual resolution of the issue, and that's in the courts. I think this is just too close that it's not going to be decided anywhere but that. And I think that this is going to highlight to people that justice and the law is what judges say it is. I mean, I think we'd all like to believe that we have these kinds of laws in place for a reason, and that should something happen, we have these laws to fall back on. But in this case, I think it's pretty clear that the law and the result of this election is going to be decided most probably by two women and seven men who live in Washington and decide these things for us. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Dean. Professor?
That is exactly my sense of ultimately how all this is going to get resolved. You know, we will have court cases in Florida that will, you know, rule one way or another on the various questions that have come up. Eventually, because this is a federal election, it will go through the appellate process, end up at the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. And think about the following interesting irony. The next president is likely to be able to make two, three, or maybe even four appointments to the Supreme Court, which everybody knows, you know, is probably going to have the effect of really transforming that body. The Supreme Court essentially is going to be given the chance to decide Bush or Gore. You know, up or down vote, whatever they say is going to go. That is, you know, just ironic, and, you know, people may have problems with that when it eventually comes down.
I was just going to say, do you really think that's likely where this will end up?
I do, because clearly there are going to be court challenges to the Palm Beach County ballot and whether, you know, that effectively is a free choice.
I need to interject here, however, because I have read some scenarios, but even if you expedite the case, it takes it a long time to get to the Supreme Court.
Well, actually, that will not be the case here. This will be an expedited case. It certainly may take several weeks or perhaps even longer, but you can actually have a county judge in Florida, you know, hear the case and make a ruling, and then basically the petition will be to take it directly to the Supreme Court and essentially skip the intermediate steps. Now, the Supreme Court could say, no, we don't want to hear it right away. But given the national importance of this ruling, they know they can't, you know, send it down and take, you know, 6 months to go through the appellate process. So my guess is there is a very good chance that the Supreme Court will decide this, and there will be 9 people in Washington essentially choosing the next 3 members of the U.S. Supreme Court.
We're going to go to Ray in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm a government worker taking the day off today and also a 12-year election judge. I kind of started out with count the vote and move on, but we're kind of under the rule of law in this country, and it's, I think, just amazing to have applied constitutional scholars trying to determine how far to push history, examining the intent of the Founding Fathers. Basically, as an election judge, we're trying to look at the voters' intent and whether there was confusion on the Palm Beach ballot or not. I think comes down to the county elected election supervisor and when's he up for election next. But overall, I think it's a great experience for the American people to look at how government is formed, how decisions are made, and what the citizens' role in it. It's a great civics lesson that kind of goes from elementary school, and I agree we'll probably go to the Supreme Court. And I guess I would put my money on Dennis Haskert taking the oath on January 2nd.
Okay, thanks, Ray.
Well, speaking of the succession, there is an interesting wrinkle here, which is, you know, the Senate, if this is not resolved by Inauguration Day, the Senate can appoint an acting vice president. However, if the Senate ends up deadlocked 50-50, they may not be able to reach an agreement, in which case we start going down the line of succession, which does go straight to the Speaker of the House. But he would have to resign his speakership in order to be acting president. And I personally would be surprised if he chose to do that. If he turns it down, the next person in line is Strom Thurmond, and that would be complete chaos if we essentially had a 97-year-old guy who is in very poor health and has had, you know, major difficulties even doing his current job, end up being next in line to be acting president while we await this process to get resolved.
Could he waive that?
He could. But,
so who would it go to after that?
Actually, I'm not even sure at that point. I think we may actually end up going to cabinet officers.
Okay, we're going to go to Dara in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, according to these Associated Press numbers, how is it possible that this recount is producing such a, you know, like such a smaller margin in the votes?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that either. I actually have been mystified by why there has been a systematic advantage for Gore over Bush on the recounts, because you would think if there was either voter confusion, it was a question of, you know, the hole was not completely punched through, that many of those things would not be a systematic advantage for the Democrat over the Republican. I mean, the only exception to that is the Palm Beach ballot, where there does appear to be a systematic disadvantage against Gore, if, you know, we trust the reports that have come out. But statewide, that should not have been an issue. So frankly, I don't understand why there has been as big a change, because when you look at other cases of ballot recounts, it's actually pretty rare for a recount to alter the original count that came out.
We're going to go to Delia in Mound. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. I want to mention a couple of things. One is on the issue that you just talked about. The issue with the difference right now, the Associated Press, which is not an official counting of the difference in votes, it's saying that it's 327 votes. This is a very unofficial vote that it's given by reporters to the Associated Press. If you ask the Secretary of State in Florida, they will tell you that up to this point, the official count from 53 counties is 1,784 votes Bush ahead. So you still have four more counties to go. But this unofficial vote is not correct, and it's been all over the media, and I don't know why they're making emphasis. My second point is that the popular vote is yet not final, because in California alone, there are 1 million outstanding overseas by mail ballots that have yet not been counted, as well as hundreds in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Oregon. So, I mean, these are two big issues that I'm just kind of surprised that people are not even talking about, and they're just going by kind of like with the exit polls, you know, going by this Associated Press number that is totally misleading for the public.
All right. Thank you, Delia.
Well, that is the dilemma of this whole election. You know, it's like once you start looking under the rock, you know, there are all sorts of problems that could emerge here, because it's not just a situation where there were ballot problems in Florida and was a close race and, you know, who knows how that's going to work out. There are four or five states where essentially the election margin is, you know, less than one-tenth of one percentage points. Some of those states still have outstanding ballots, absentee ballots, mail ballots, overseas ballots to count. You know, that's what could turn what now is a problem into a crisis. If we essentially end up delegitimizing our own very election process, we have a big problem on our hands. And then all of the foreign criticism that you were alluding to earlier then is going to seriously escalate.
Does that give any legitimacy to the Bush campaign's pleas with the Gores that they're going to provoke a crisis?
Well, I think the lesson here, both for Bush and Gore, and obviously, you know, at this point, we don't know who ultimately is going to emerge out of the recount as having the most votes, but whoever is the second place loser should really pay attention to Richard Nixon in 1960, where Nixon lost a very close election. Nationally, it was decided by less than one-tenth of 1%. There were allegations of fraud in Chicago, which were probably well-founded. And Nixon faced the option of, should he contest the election, play the fraud card, basically demand, file a lawsuit and demand, you know, all sorts of remedies. He decided it was not, even though it would have been in his personal self-interest to pursue those options, that it would not be in the interests of the country, and he let it go.
Well, I'm going to quibble with you there, because there are historians who disagree on that note. I know that President Nixon, in his memoir, said that he decided to forego that, but there were investigations that went on. There were two of his lieutenants from his campaign, in fact, who made sure that some investigations went on quietly. I give you that, but still.
Well, there's a difference between quiet investigations and essentially having public demonstrations and rallies and sending your aides out on national television to say, mm-hmm. quote, there are irregularities that are taking place, and either we or people that we're working with are going to file suit here. Nixon never really did any of those things, and I think at some point either Gore or Bush are going to be in that situation where they're going to have to ask themselves, you know, what's best for the country? And I hope that whoever is the second place finisher will at some point put his will put the country's self-interest above his own political self-interest.
All right, let's go to Wayne in Fargo. Wayne, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, good morning. I was just would like to point out to people, this is, as far as I can see, an orderly process of recount. First, you run through the machine all the ballots that have gone through the machine the first time, and the numbers in the state have come down. But these 19,000 ballots are not necessarily spoiled and not going to be counted. These are ones that didn't go through the machine. Just like an optical scanner, if you mark the thing but you don't fully fill in the center of the place, it'll kick out. The machines are set to both kick out for overvoting and undervoting. These are the ones that are going to be hand counting here.
What about the ones where they voted twice and punched two holes?
That's what's called an overvote.
But how can you possibly tell?
There's also what's called undervoting. If the machine is is set up that if they don't, if it doesn't see a vote in both the presidential level and this one and in the various offices, the vote will be kicked out to be looked at later. It's not that it's already invalid and will never be looked at again. That's why they're doing a hand count in four counties.
But, Wayne, how, if you've punched two holes for the presidency, how is someone going to know which one they're supposed to count?
That will be a job of the board that sits down and looks at these. There will be arguments made that if somebody makes a straight party line vote all for Bush and makes a mistake and votes this Gore, Buchanan and then Bush, double punches, there will be arguments in the group that sits, it's usually about 3 to 5 people, will have to vote what was the intent of that person. Well, we can see they voted a straight party ticket. I don't think they're going to be voting for Buchanan.
Now, Wayne,
and the same argument could be made for
a vote.
Those probably overvotes won't be counted.
Okay,
but
Wayne,
some of those
stop, Wayne. I want to know how you know all this. And how is it?
I've worked on recounts before.
In Florida?
No, in North Dakota, and I also helped recount a small county, one in Minnesota. I'm 44 and I have years old. I have worked on elections before. It does kick out things that don't look like a vote and turn out to be votes. So those have to be gone through to see if there are ones that the machine said was an undervote, in other words, no vote for a presidential level, and actually is a partial punch through and only a single punch.
No, Wayne, I got that, but I guess my question would be, there's no assurance that's how things are going to happen in Florida.
I didn't say there's an assurance. The board has to sit there in this hand count and look at the questionable ballots and decide on those. Then those are the ones that one party or the other could very well challenge in those court cases. But each one of these ballots have to be looked at. Just because a machine says it's not good enough doesn't mean that ballot is toast and no person looks at those ballots.
Okay, well, Wayne, I'm very glad that you called.
Thank you. Bye.
Professor?
Well, I mean, I agree with many of the things that Wayne pointed out, but I would just add one point to that. You know, the Gore people have asked for a hand count of individual ballots in four counties. You know, who's to say Bush won't turn around and say, okay, let's count, do an individual hand count of the other 63 counties, and then whoever then is behind after we do that, who's to say they're not going to go to Iowa, Wisconsin, and Oregon, and New Mexico and say, you know, we should do a hand count there, too. That's what is very risky about this whole process. That's what potentially could end up extending this process weeks and weeks.
I guess where I'm confused, and I'd be curious to hear what you heard when Wayne was talking, I would think that with thousands of people on the street in Palm Beach, if they were actually going to go through and try to save as many of those disqualified votes as they could, wouldn't they have told people by now?
Probably. I mean, my sense is that most of the ballots in Palm Beach County that were disqualified because the person had voted for two candidates. Obviously, even if they do a hand count, those ballots are not going to be counted because you could never determine the true intent of the voter.
Well, and of course, Wayne was arguing otherwise. We're going to go to Mike in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I would like to call and offer what I hope is a uplifting reaffirmation for all of us, and that's to say that when I look at the situation, I don't see doom and gloom. I don't see a system gone awry or lost or a system that is done. I see a system that almost everyone agrees will work. We don't see any signs of a coup. We don't see people taking arms or starting revolutionary groups. We don't see people saying, I won't accept it unless my person's accepted. I won't accept it unless it goes this way. I think whatever way is decided, whether it's the Supreme Court or the Electoral College or the California courts, the Florida courts, I think people will accept it and move on. And I think that's an affirmation to the level to which our society has confirmed democracy and is committed to it. And there's also the positive side that this close election has brought out a lot of interest. People have learned a lot about how democracy works, and it reaffirms for the future how important each individual vote is. That's all I've got.
Well, Mike, I feel like you should say go in peace.
Go in peace.
Thank you. Professor?
I hope Mike is right. I would feel very good if that is the ultimate outcome. And I think that if the process kind of, you know, concludes in the next week or two, we have a pretty good shot of reaching that type of conclusion. My fear is that either party is going to just keep contesting this in every venue all across the country, and the longer it goes on, the more contentiousness there is, and the less legitimate people will feel at the end of that. So it's really kind of worrying about how this thing may unfold that is my personal cause for concern.
Well, and in fact, let's talk about whoever does become president. Can we even use the word mandate?
Certainly not. I mean, when you have an election that was so closely divided, whatever the outcome, clearly the country is very divided right now between two different visions. It's not just at the presidential level, but we saw the same degree of competitiveness in the House and in the Senate. So basically, somehow we need to find leaders who will bring back bipartisanship. We've had far too much partisan politics in Washington. Voters, we know, are sick of that. We hope our leaders in Washington get that message out of this election.
Let's go to Gail in Lake Elmo. Gail, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I just wanted to do some clarification. It was my understanding from your previous speaker that, in fact, this election is going to get decided by the state of Florida, by the Florida courts and the Florida legislature. It won't go to the U.S. Supreme Court. It wouldn't be reviewable by the U.S. Supreme Court if, in fact, it's a Florida Supreme Court issue. And so that's really what I was calling. I don't think it has the litigation potential that the speaker is addressing.
Well, if the caller is certainly correct that right now it is state laws that are at stake. But there have been some indications from Democratic Party officials that they may pursue a civil rights angle or a general a kind of class action type of thing that could move this from a state court to a federal court. And, in fact, some Democrats believe they actually have a better shot in a federal court as opposed to a state court. So if they choose to pursue legal options in that way, then that would turn it into a federal issue and would ultimately put it in the Supreme Court.
Tell us when you think this could be. I'm trying to come up with a word here. When's the soonest this could end, come to a resolution?
Well, the soonest would be a week from Friday, because it's really at that point where we will have the machine recount, presumably the manual recount of the four counties will be done by then, and the overseas ballots will be in. So at that point, the Florida officials will have the opportunity to basically say, okay, this is the result, this is the count, and we are certifying either Bush or Gore as the winner. At that junction, the only thing that would then stop it would be if there are lawsuits that are and the people are found to have a proper standing to pursue it. That is the only thing that would extend it much further.
Professor West, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Darrell West is a professor of political science at Brown University in Rhode Island. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Want to remind you that if you've missed any mid-morning shows for the last week, you go online to Minnesota.